Don't you deserve a Medicare plan you can count on? Well, you can count on a Medicare Advantage plan from UnitedHealthcare. Enjoy reliable coverage and low out-of-pocket costs with a Medicare Advantage plan from UnitedHealthcare. And if you have a chronic condition like diabetes, chronic heart failure, or a cardiovascular disorder, you may qualify for a UnitedHealthcare Complete Care plan with plans that fit your life today and as your needs change tomorrow. Find out more about UnitedHealthcare plans at uhc.com/Medicare.
Hello, and welcome back to ACRAC. I'm Jed Wolpaw, and you got it. We have back Dr. Jillian Isaac for another keyword episode. Today, we are going to be discussing the ABA keyword of adrenal disease, both for the basic and advanced exam. Jillian, thanks so much for coming back on the show.
You're welcome. I'm going to apologize in advance if you hear dogs barking. I have some work being done on the house and the contractor's here. My dog doesn't really like them. So.
No worries at all.
Ignore the dogs barking. Okay. Yeah. So as Dr. Wolpaw said, we are going to be talking about adrenal disease, both for the basic and advanced. I have learned that residents don't look at this content outline that the ABA publishes because I think it's just overwhelming, but I know it inside and out. So that's always where I start, is like kind of what the ABA wants you to know. So if you're looking for the basic, it's on page 21 of the outline, and it's under organ-based basic and clinical sciences and under endocrine, and they want you to know the physiology of the adrenal cortex and the adrenal medulla, along with all the other endocrine organs, obviously. And then they want you to know like all the biochemistry and the histology. So kind of what you learned in USMLE. And I do know, like in speaking with Bob Geiser, that a lot of the basic, about half of it, is a revisit of USMLE stuff. So I say that because if you feel like you didn't really understand this the first time around, or you kind of struggle with these concepts, you probably need to revisit them. So that's what the basic wants you to know, is like really truly medical school basic stuff. And then for the advanced, they want to take that medical school knowledge and have you apply it into anesthesia. So they want you to know about the different disease states. So Cushing disease, primary aldosteronism, which is also called Kahn syndrome, Addison's disease, and then pheochromocytoma. And of pheo, they want you to know about the circulatory and metabolic manifestations, how it's diagnosed, and the anesthetic managements of those. So that's what we're going to go through today. I would say this is like a fairly high yield topic, but the hard piece is picking out of these, the high yield. You know, you're probably going to get a few questions that have to do with the adrenal physiology and disease states. My money, if I had to bet, if I was in Las Vegas, I'd probably pick pheochromocytoma and maybe like a Cushing's disease, and then the primary hyperaldosteronism. That would be like, if I had to pick what I think they're going to test. Do you remember from like your studying?
Yeah,
days?
I feel like it. Almost always you're going to have something pheo related. I agree. And then either Cushing's or Addison's, either hyper or hypoaldosterone, hyper or hypocortisolemia, like one, something in there.
Something in that arena, right?
Yeah.
Because there are a lot of things that mix, right? Because you got the hypothalamus and the pituitary and then the adrenal and that whole axis and the negative feedback loop. So there's a lot they can ask you. Yeah. So what is on the test? So that's what the ABA wants you to know. So what is on the test? So I use the website Open Anesthesia to try to determine what's on the test. And what they do is they list the date that it was last updated. So I think Open Anesthesia, they look at the keywords that were published after the test was administered, and then they update their keyword. So if the keyword was updated in 2020, you know that that's like an active keyword. So I try to put on the keywords that have been in the last like 5 to 7 years. So for the basic, it's aldosterone, the physiology that was updated in 2020, and regulation, like we talked about, the feedback loops of all of that. And then they want you to know how the adrenal medulla is connected to the sympathetic nervous system, the ganglia and the neurotransmitters. That was tested in 2020. And then they want you to know about glucocorticoids and mineralocorticoid activity. That was tested in 2016. So not listed in open anesthesia, but I think that are still very fair game. I think the zones of the adrenal cortex, like the glomerulosa, fasciculata, those are probably still out there somewhere in the question banks. And then the synthesis of epinephrine in the adrenal medulla, if you think way back to like your amino acid, the tyrosine going to dopamine, going to norepi, like I still think that is fair game because I've seen those questions kind of circulate around, even though I didn't find them on open anesthesia. And then for the advanced, keep in mind when you're studying for the advanced that 25% of it is basic. So the stuff we all just talked about is coming around. But they want you to know about adrenal insufficiency lab findings that was tested in 2020 and the treatment that was 2015 question. Congenital adrenal hypoplasia, that was tested in 2021. I actually couldn't find any questions about that, but it's probably because it's a newer one and the newer question banks. They want you to know about Addison's disease, including blood chemistry and perioperative treatment. That's a 2015 question. And then pheochromocytoma. So a fair number of things here. So the treatment of an acute high blood pressure episode in the OR, preoperative preparation, diagnostic markers, alpha blockade, beta blockade. So that's, like we talked about, probably the more high yield subject. And then hormone stress response and stress dose steroids in 2015. I will say it's hard to ask questions about stress dose steroids because I still think there's some, I don't know, what's the right word? Controversy. There's not clear-cut guidelines, right? So they're not going to ask something that's not a clear-cut guideline, but it's still something important to think about and study.
Okay. And I think it does come up a lot. I mean, they may not ask you exactly the dose or you know, that kind of thing, but the scenario of a patient who, you know, for example, is hypotensive, you know, out of proportion, and you can't find anything else. Yeah, sorry. Forget I said that. Okay.
Yeah, exactly. It does come up. Exactly. All right. So we're going to start with the basic. Just for a quick review. So the adrenal gland has two major components. There's the cortex and then the medulla. The cortex has three zones. It's the glomerulosa, the fasciculata, and the reticularis. I remember GFR, just like for the kidneys. So GFR. And then each zone synthesizes a different hormone. I remember salt, sugar, sex. So SSS. So the salt is aldosterone. The sugar are the glucocorticoids. And then the sex are the androgens and the estrogens. And then the adrenal medulla is the innermost part of the adrenal gland, and it consists of chromaffin cells that secrete catecholamine. So that includes epinephrine, norepinephrine, and dopamine in response to sympathetic preganglionic neurons. Okay, so we're going to do the basic questions first. And the key point here is that the adrenal medulla is part of the autonomic nervous system. The chromaffin cells release catecholamines in response to stress, and the amino acid precursor of epinephrine, norepinephrine, and dopamine is tyrosine. And that I've seen those questions. Okay, so question one. Each of the following statements about the anatomy of the autonomic nervous system is true except. Now, I know the ABA has gotten away from except questions, and I know that they've gotten down to three answer options. So if you see one that has five or four answer choices, they're older. But I still think there's a lot to be learned from doing these questions just for practice. So if I'm doing an except question, I start doing it kind of like a true false. So again, each of the following statements about the anatomy of the autonomic nervous system is true except. So A, preganglionic cell bodies are located in the central nervous system. B, postganglionic neurons are located in outlying ganglia. C, the parasympathetic ganglia are located near their target organs. D, the adrenal gland is innervated only by the sympathetic nervous system. Or E, the parasympathetic nervous system has thoracic and sacral segments.
So I just want to highlight one thing you just said, which I think from a test-taking skill standpoint is really important, which is if you ever do see one of these, you know, all of the following except questions, I would do exactly what Jillian just said and go through each question and literally write a T or an F. Is it true or is it false? And then go back and figure out how that helps you answer the question, because otherwise you can get very turned around. I am a very good test taker, and I have gotten these questions wrong because I somehow in my head, I flipped around what they were asking. That's why they're starting to get rid of them, and hopefully have gotten rid of them completely. But if you ever find one that hasn't been dumped, do this, do what Jillian said, do the true false. So let's do that. So
is just say which of the following is false. Because it's kind of weird to say true except, right? So you're just trying to find the false statement.
Okay, exactly. So let's go through. So preganglionic cell bodies are located in the central nervous system. Is that true or false? So that is true, right? That is where the preganglionic cell bodies are located. So that we now know is true. Now you don't have to, you could go through them all before you start crossing out, or you can remember that anything that's true, you're going to cross out. Okay, so we're going to say, great, we cross that one out. Next, postganglionic neurons are located in outlying ganglia. So that is also true. And so we can cross that one out. Next, the parasympathetic ganglia are located near their target organs. And this, again, is true. And by the way, these are things you're just going to have to know, right? There's no, I think, trick to knowing. You just have to remember this about the parasympathetic. So that's true. You can cross it out. And then the adrenal gland is innervated only by the sympathetic nervous system. That's also true. We can cross that out. If there is a way to remember that, I think, which is that you know the adrenal gland is all about norepi and epi, right? The catechols. So those are the sympathetic nervous system. And so that's an easy way to remember that it's only innervated by the sympathetic nervous system. And then finally, we're left with only one. So we know it's the right answer. The parasympathetic nervous system has thoracic and sacral segments, and that's false.
And the sympathetic does, has the thoracic sacral. Yeah. So E is the correct answer. And I will just say that one of the reasons why I pulled this question is there is a lot of overlap. And the more you do these keywords, the more you start finding all the overlaps between them. But when we get to like the parasympathetic nervous system and the sympathetic nervous system, they really want you to know this level of detail, very granular, especially on the basic. All right, the next question. Within the chromatin cells of the adrenal medulla, which ion's influx is an absolute requirement for epinephrine secretion? A, calcium, B, sodium, C, chloride, D, potassium. And I will say when I was pulling questions, I always do these, like, you know, see if I get them right or wrong. And I got this one right, that it was a little bit of a guess.
And I would say if you ever have to guess what is the final ion that causes, you know, secretion of something, if you have to guess something, guess calcium. I mean, that is more often than not going to be the answer, if not always. And it is indeed the answer here. But if you think about, you know, nerve cells, it is, of course, the, you know, other ions down the length of the axon causing the perpetuation of the signal. And then at the end, it's the calcium coming in that causes acetylcholine release, right? So it's just often that's the case in our bodies that calcium is the answer.
And it is calcium. And that's exactly how I thought about it, is that I was like, well, sodium, potassium, chloride, they're more at the membrane. Calcium is usually the one in the cell that's causing these things to happen. And that's true. So in this case, calcium triggers the fusion of vesicles containing the epinephrine with the cell membrane, allowing the release of epinephrine into the bloodstream. So without the calcium, then you could not have that occur. Okay. So the next question, I pulled this one because you do see questions like this. It's like in a table format. And so it's going to be a little harder to say it correctly, like in terms of someone who can't see it. But I think, do you put these on your website? Like you could probably pull it up and look at it. But so the question is, what branch of the autonomic nervous system elicits catecholamine release from the adrenal medulla? And what is the neurotransmitter and receptor responsible for increased epinephrine release from the adrenal medullary chromatin cells? So it has the branch of the ANS and then neurotransmitter and then the receptor. And you have to decide. So A is parasympathetic for the ANS branch, norepi for the neurotransmitter, and then alpha-1 for the receptor. B is sympathetic, norepi, alpha-1. C is sympathetic, acetylcholine, and muscarinic. D is parasympathetic, acetylcholine, muscarinic. And then E is sympathetic, acetylcholine, nicotinic. And this is actually like, as someone who does write a lot of test questions, it's very representative what you're going to see. It might not be as like big of a table, but basically they want to know what's going down, what's going up, or like what receptors are involved. I personally got this one wrong when I was doing this. So just if it makes you feel any better, I did not get this one correct.
Well, so I'll tell you how I would approach it. So first, and this is how I approach these in general, is first I would say, let's look at column A, the first column. Okay. Because if we know the answer to that, we get rid of either three or two of them. And so we just said that we know the adrenal gland is just sympathetic. So we can get rid of both of the parasympathetic. All right. So we can get we don't have to look at column B and C for those. We know that it can't be A and it can't be D because those both say that it's the sympathetic branch of the ANS and we know it can't be. So now we're down to three. And even if you don't know anything else, you've got a better chance of guessing with three than you did a five. So now we go to the second one, neurotransmitter. And then we just have to ask ourselves, is it norepinephrine or is it acetylcholine? And so it's, you know, hopefully, you know, it's going to be acetylcholine at these, the neurotransmitter that's responsible at the adrenal medulla. And so if you don't know that, you're going to have to guess. If you do know that, you can get rid of one more because that's the other norepinephrine. So now we're down to three. Now we're down to two,
yeah,
right? So you can now. You now have a 50% chance.
Yeah, that's where I messed it up.
Right. So now you just have to know, is it nicotinic or muscarinic?
Right.
And, you know, I think that I probably would have done what you did as my guest, Jillian, and guessed muscarinic because nicotinic, when I think of nicotinic, I think of the smooth muscles. I think of the muscle cells, right? I think of the fact that we have nicotinic receptors at our muscles. That's what happens when we use a neuromuscular blockers, right? We paralyze at the nicotinic receptors. When we use an anti-muscarinic, we are blocking just the muscarinic receptors, but not those nicotinic receptors. And I should say, sorry, that a neuromuscular blocker is going to do all muscarinic and nicotinic, but we then give, if we're using a neostigmine, we then give glycopyrrolate to block the muscarinic effect so that we only get the nicotinic. But here, it turns out, I think that's not right, right? The answer here is actually nicotinic.
Right. So the branch of the ANS that elicits the catecholamine release is a sympathetic. The neurotransmitter is acetylcholine, and then the receptor that is actually responsible for increased epinephrine release is nicotinic. So,
yeah. So that's just something you're going to have to know.
Yeah. And that's like Anki, I don't know how you say it, but the flashcard, that's a great flashcard right there. Okay. Yep. Next question. In the synthesis of adrenal medullary hormones, cortisol stimulates the conversion of A, tyrosine to DOPA, B, dopamine to DOPA, C, tyrosine to dopamine, D, epinephrine to norepinephrine, or E, norepinephrine to epinephrine.
Yeah. And so again, here you're just going to have to know this, that it is norepinephrine to epinephrine.
Yeah. So that pathway, it's tyrosine gets converted to DOPA, and then DOPA gets converted to dopamine, and then dopamine to norepi, and then norepi to epi. And I'm sorry that question's not going away, but it's not. Because tyrosine, because there's so many questions you can ask there, right? Dopamine, norepinephrine, epinephrine. Okay. And the next question is in a very similar vein. In situations of stress and anxiety, epinephrine synthesis can be increased when cortisol stimulates which enzyme. So now you have to know what enzyme actually increases the conversion of norepi to epi. So is it tyrosine hydroxylase? Is it amino acid decarboxylase, which is B? Is it COMT, which is catecholamine methyl transferase? Is it D, monoamine oxidase? And is it E, I'm going to butcher how you say this, phenylethanolamine and methyl transferase? Nailed it. PNMT.
Well done. Yeah. And again, something you just have to memorize, that it is PNMT. So it's answer choice E here.
Yeah. Well, I had a little bit of mental gymnastics in my head, if you want to know, because I got this right, but not because I knew the answer. So tyrosine hydroxylase, that's going to probably do something to tyrosine, right? So like, yep. It's probably not that one. And an amino acid decarboxylase is probably also going to do something to your amino acid. So it's probably not going to be B. And then in my head, I had these vague memories of like MAOI and COMT being really important in like putting away epi, you know, like the recycling of it. And so that's how I got to E, but not because I actually like memorized that fact.
Yeah, that's great. If you got that knowledge, I'm impressed. That will work too.
Okay. And then last in the basic question section is, which hormone is produced by the zona reticularis? A, endostrandione. I don't think I said that right. B, melatonin. C, aldosterone. D, cortisol. E, angiotensin II. Androstenedione. Yep. There you go.
Androstenedione, yeah, which is the answer here. And again, I think that's probably something that you can probably use the mnemonics that you shared a little bit, that's right? Salt. The salt, sugar, sex, the deeper you go, the better it gets. That I remember learning that in medical school. And
that's better than mine.
that may help you a little bit here to kind of think through it. But ultimately, I think you're going to have to know. I mean, I guess on one hand, you know, angiotensin II and melatonin, you could probably get rid of. So you're really left with aldosterone, cortisol, or androstenedione.
The first layer, right? G, and the cortisol is your second letter, F. So, yeah.
Right.
So I don't know androstenedione, but I could eliminate the other ones. And sometimes, like, that's the trick of standardized tests. Like, it's a logic problem sometimes. You don't always have to know the answer. You just have to be able to knock other ones out.
Right.
So we are laying to rest the basic, and we're moving on to the advanced. Okay. So our second key point of the day is the axis. So the hypothalamus secretes CRH, which is cortisol-releasing hormone, and then that stimulates the anterior pituitary to release ACTH. ACTH works on the adrenal gland kind of twofold. It can work to cause aldosterone release, but also cortisol release. Adrenal insufficiency can be primary or secondary. Addison's disease is a primary adrenal insufficiency caused by adrenal gland destruction. Most commonly, it's autoimmune, but it could also be like tuberculosis is another one, or infection. And then without the adrenal cortex, so you're going to have low amounts of aldosterone. So you're going to get hyponatremia and hypokalemia with volume insufficiency. And with low cortisol, you're going to be like tired and have hypotension. And then you can have secondary secondary adrenal insufficiency if the pituitary or the hypothalamus aren't working correctly, which is probably the more common scenario, is it's coming from the brain than the actual adrenal gland, but it can happen in the adrenal gland itself. Okay, so first question, which of the following is most likely to be a manifestation of adrenal suppression? A, hypokalemia, B, hypernatremia, C, hypotension, D, hypothermia.
Yeah. So it's going to be C, hypotension. That hopefully should be easy just because that's what we think of. We kind of touched on this before when Jillian said I was giving away the answers. But, you know, when you think of adrenal insufficiency, you think of that at least around anesthesia and surgery. You think about that hypotension. And then if you think about the action that it, when you have cortisol, it causes retention of sodium. And so when you don't have it, you're going to lose sodium. So it would be hyponatremia and hyperkalemia. So it's the opposite of A and B. You can get rid of those. And then while you certainly can get hypothermia, that's less common.
Right. So hypotension C is the correct answer there. All right. Next question. So we have a 49-year-old man with Addison disease. He presents for hernia repair. All of the following statements about Addison's disease are true except. So we have another except question. So we're going to do the true false game again. So A, patients with this condition undergoing even minor procedures require a stress dose of steroids intraoperatively and a long postoperative taper. B, typical lab abnormalities include hyponatremia and hyperkalemia. C, Addison disease is a type of primary adrenal insufficiency caused by adrenal gland destruction. D, both skin hyperpigmentation and vitiligo are signs of Addison disease. And E, common symptoms in untreated Addison disease are diarrhea and orthostatic hypotension.
Yeah. So again, we could go through all of them. We'll say that, let's just for the sake of brevity here, we'll do A, which turns out is the right answer. Patients with this condition undergoing even minor procedures require stress dose of steroids intraoperatively and a long postoperative taper. So that's false, which means it's the correct answer to this question. And the reason it's false is that, and there's some debate about this, which is I think what you were getting at earlier, Jillian, is that it's not exactly a perfect guideline. But in general, a very minor procedure, someone may not even need anything, especially if they took their usual daily dose of, let's say, prednisone. They may not need any stress dose. Certainly, if they do need a stress dose, they don't need a long postoperative taper.
And that's the key there, is a very minor procedure. And so you're not going to need that taper. I think, again, like you may or may not do the stress dose. But I like this question because they leave it open-ended. They don't say you have to give a stress dose or you have to do this. Okay. So the next question is, it's another table format. So we have a 48-year-old who has a family history of his family history of heart disease. He has followed a heart healthy lifestyle for 15 years. However, he has recently experienced unusual fatigue and lightheadedness, especially when rising suddenly. Physical exam demonstrates postural hypotension and a darker than usual complexion for midwinter in the Midwest. He works and exercises indoors. Lab work reveals that he is hyponatremic, hyperkalemic, and hypocalcemic. Further blood tests are ordered to assay plasma corticotropin-releasing hormone, CRH, corticotropin, ACTH, and cortisol. What combination of hyper and or hyposecretion for these hormones would be the most likely given this man's signs and symptoms? So they're going to tell you CRH, ACTH, cortisol, and you have to say if it's high secretion or low secretion. Right.
And so the first thing you want to do is try to get a picture in your head, like, what are we talking about here? And the fact they're giving us, right, the hyponatremia, the hyperkalemia, et cetera. So he's got the dark. And then the other key things here are his appearance, right? So he's got the hypotension, and then he's also got the darker than usual complexion, that hyperpigmentation. And so this suggests that what's happening here is his adrenal gland itself is not working, but that his the pituitary axis is working. And so what you're going to have is a bunch of CRH, therefore causing a bunch of ACTH, but it's not doing anything in terms of getting secretion from the adrenal. So it keeps ramping up. And it's that ACTH that's in incredibly high doses that's causing the hyperpigmentation. And so the answer is going to be hypersecretion of CRH, hypersecretion of ACTH, and then hyposecretion of cortisol from the adrenal itself.
But these type of, the way they format this question is like very common on the basic and the advanced. Again, it's not as easy to do it over a podcast, but if you saw it, you'd understand. This is just such, for me, an interesting aside, is that JFK actually had Addison's disease. Mm-hmm. And that's why he kind of looked permanently tanned, even if it was like middle of the winter. And it's because one of the like the pre-pro hormones, I think if I'm remembering this correctly, of ACTH, like when you cut a piece off, it's actually like a melatonin hormone. That's why they get darker color. We have all of this, right, circulating around. So just if that helps you remember, sometimes putting a story helps. Okay. So last question here in the adrenal insufficiency category, you have a patient with lethargy, nausea, and reported muscle weakness is given a series of tests to rule out physical causes. During these tests, it's revealed that plasma corticotropin is above normal and cortisol is below normal. Renin is above normal and aldosterone is below normal. Adrenal androgens are below normal. Which of the following clinical conditions would most likely produce this set of signs and symptoms? A, Cushing's disease. B, ectopic corticotropin-producing tumor. C, secondary renal insufficiency. D, congenital adrenal hyperplasia. Or E, Addison's disease.
Stay with us. We'll be right back with the answer to that question. All right, and we're back. Right, so the constellation they're giving you is that the adrenal gland itself is not working, right? So you've got the cortisol is below normal, as is the aldosterone. And the adrenal androgen. So the whole thing they're telling you is down. So it can't be Cushing's. That would be elevated cortisol. It can't be an ectopic corticotropin producing tumor because that would be causing excess secretion of things from the adrenal. It can't be renal insufficiency because the whole adrenal is down. And then it can't be congenital adrenal hyperplasia because I think that is just part of the, that's only going to affect the steroid, the glucocorticoid part. I'm not 100% sure, but Addison's disease is the whole adrenal itself being malfunctioning. And that's what the correct answer is here is E.
And remember I said in open anesthesia that congenital adrenal hyperplasia is on the test. This is the only question I found that actually had that referenced in there. So just FYI. Okay, yeah. So the next.
And I want to be clear. I'm not an expert by any means on congenital adrenal hyperplasia. It's definitely not going to cause loss or low values of all of the things the adrenal secretes, but don't quote me on the exact reason for that.
Okay. So our next key point is pheochromocytoma. It's a type of neuroendocrine tumor that grows from chromatin cells. It can be associated with MEN2. Usually the tumors are benign. Signs and symptoms include hypertension, tachycardia, sweating, and they can come in like attacks. Patients need to be adequately prepared before surgery with alpha and then beta blockers. And there's a very high morbidity and mortality associated with emergency surgery in patients with either undiagnosed or known pheochromocytomas. Okay, so these are questions that I found with pheos. All right, so we have a middle-aged man with a known pheochromocytoma. He's scheduled for elective abdominal surgery. Which one of the following statements about his pre-operative pharmacological management is correct? A, alpha adrenergic blockade is instituted at the same time as beta blockade. B, diuretic antihypertensives are contraindicated. C, preoperative drug therapy should be started 12 hours before surgery. D, dosage is adjusted according to levels of urinary catecholamine metabolites. E, calcium channel blockers are contraindicated in this condition.
And so what you want to think about is someone who has a pheo is going to have a ton of catechols around. It's going to cause a few things. It's going to cause them to need some anti-alpha. It's going to cause them to be volume down because they're so vasoconstricted that they're going to be relatively volume down. And so you want to keep that in mind. So the first thing you do is alpha block them. You don't beta block them at the same time so that we can get rid of A, because A is that you do both alpha and beta at the same time. Diuretics are contraindicated as antihypertensives, and that's true because remember when you get them on the alpha blockade and they then lose some of that intense vasoconstriction, they're going to be hypovolemic, and so you don't want to give them diuretics. So that's going to be the answer because
that's correct.
It is correct that it's contraindicated. Yeah, in my head for a second, I was thinking we were looking for the following except.
Yeah.
So that is correct. They're contraindicated, so B is the answer. The other ones are not correct, right? So we talked about C, preoperative drug therapy should be started 12 hours before surgery. No, it needs to be started weeks before surgery. Dosage is adjusted according to levels of urinary catecholamine metabolites. That's not true. What you're doing is you're giving an alpha blocker to treat the symptoms. That's not going to treat the catecholamine metabolites. And then calcium channel blockers are contraindicated in this condition. That is also not true. You can use them, but you're going to start with your alpha blockers.
Yeah. And if I remember, there is like a set of guidelines of what systolic and diastolic you should have like in pre-op. So the guidance is more about numbers and less about that you don't do the urinary catecholamine metabolites. Okay, so next question. Pheochromocytoma would most likely coexist with which of the following? A, insulinoma, B, pituitary adenoma, C, primary hyperaldosteronism, also known as Kahn syndrome, D, medullary carcinoma of the thyroid.
And I think you mentioned this, that it is medullary carcinoma of the thyroid that's most likely.
Right. So it says about 5% of cases, pheos actually are associated with MEN2, 2A or 2B, which is a pheo, thyroid, and then neuromas of the oral mucosa. Okay, next one. A 48-year-old, 111-kilogram female presents for a surgical excision of a pheochromocytoma, for which she has already received a 14-day course of phenoxybenzamine. The patient is scheduled for a combined epidural and general anesthetic. The agent that should be avoided during maintenance of anesthesia is A, nitrous oxide, B, propofol, C, desflurane, D, isoflurane, E, sevoflurane.
So they're getting at something that actually a lot of today's trainees may not know, since we hardly ever use desflurane anymore, but that is that if you rapidly increase the concentration of desflurane, it causes catechol release. And so you can get that as a side effect, and that is not something you would want in a patient with a pheo. So it's going to be desflurane that is something you want to avoid.
All right, next one. So clonidine is useful in each of the following applications except, so another except question, A, reducing blood pressure with pheochromocytoma, B, treatment of postoperative shivering, C, protection against perioperative myocardial ischemia, D, as an agent for prolonging bupivacaine spinal.
Yeah, so here's another except. So we're looking for the one that's false. And this is hopefully you got from our prior discussion. It is not how you want to reduce blood pressure with a pheo with an alpha-2 agonist that is clonidine. You want to use alpha blockers like phenoxybenzamine and phentolamine. So this is not the right answer here. Yeah. Clonidine will do those other things.
And the last question here, and I picked this one because I think sometimes a pheo can mimic other things, and it's important to be able to parse out when it's like a pheo versus like a thyroid storm or malignant hyperthermia. So a 47-year-old patient is to be operated on for a tumor of the small bowel. In the preoperative interview, a history of flushing, diarrhea, and joint pain is elicited. There are also symptoms compatible with congestive heart failure. A likely diagnosis is A, Zollinger-Ellison syndrome, B, carcinoid syndrome, C, pheochromocytoma, D, Peutz-Jeghers syndrome, E, adrenal tumor with metastases.
And really, when you're seeing that combination of the flushing and diarrhea with a bowel tumor, that's got to make you think carcinoid. And also you can get the congestive heart failure, but that's going to be much more the picture they're going to paint for carcinoid as opposed to the tachycardia, headaches, hypertension that you would think of for pheo.
And one of the keywords in this chunk of the advanced outline is actually carcinoid. So it kind of overlaps that too, just pointing that one out. All right, next question, the last one in pheo is, which of the following is least likely to be associated with multiple endocrine neoplasia type 1, MEN1? A, prolactinoma, B, parathyroid hyperplasia, C, insulinoma, D, pheochromocytoma.
Yeah, this is one of those tricky things because it's MEN2, 2A and 2B, that is associated with pheo, but MEN1 is not. And so it's actually the answer here is pheo. The other ones are associated with MEN1.
And MEN1 is PPP, so pituitary, parathyroid, pancreas. That's how I remember that one. Okay, so the next key point, I put this in here because it's asked all the time. I try to pick a question that's asked in a different way, but some drugs can cause adrenal. Oh, this is the key point. So some drugs can cause adrenal suppression, and it's usually etomidate. That's like the question that you see all the time. Here's a question that I pulled. All of the following conditions may develop when using propofol for prolonged sedation in the ICU, except A, pancreatitis, B, hyperlipidemia, C, metabolic acidosis, D, adrenal suppression.
Right. And so propofol, hopefully we all know, does not cause adrenal suppression, but it can cause those other things. And that's why whenever you have a patient in the ICU on a propofol infusion, you should be checking daily lactate, CK, and triglycerides so that you see if any of those things are developing. And those can all be precursors, at least the hyperlipidemia and the metabolic acidosis especially, can be precursors to propofol infusion syndrome. And once that happens, it's pretty fatal. So you really want to find that early and stop the propofol if that's what's happening.
I didn't pull it, but the common question is someone in the ICU getting like repeated uses of etomidate, like a burn patient, and the adrenal suppression. That's really usually how you see that one. Okay, so the next key point is that patients with long-term steroid use may need stress dose steroids, plus or minus a postoperative taper. So here's a question about steroid use is, which of the following equals the anti-inflammatory activity of 50 milligrams of prednisone? So someone's on 50 milligrams of prednisone, what is that? to us. So is that A, 100 milligrams of solu-Cortef, which is cortisol, B, 80 milligrams of methylprednisolone, which is solu-Medrol, C, 7.5 milligrams of dexamethasone, which is Decadron, or 4 milligrams of betamethasone, which is Celestone.
Yeah. So this is, you just have to know the more or less the steroid equivalents. And, you know, this, the way I think about it, just as a general rule of thumb, is not exactly right, but it's that if you take just cortisol, if you take a cortisone, like what your body produces, then that is 5 times less potent than hydrocortisone when we give it. That's 5 times less potent than methylpred and pred, and that's 5 times less potent than dexamethasone, and that being the most potent. So the, going backwards, 1 milligram, or let's say five, it's one is so small, 5 milligrams of decadron or dexamethasone is about equal to, again, this is not exactly right, but in the ballpark, is about equal to 25 to 30 of prednisone or methylprednisone. Methylprednisolone is about equal to we said 25, so about 125 of cortisol, which is about 500 of cortisone. So if you just have that in your head, you can probably get most of these right. Those numbers aren't exactly right, but here they're giving us 50. Yeah, 50 of pred. And so that's going to be about, you know, divide by five, right? About somewhere in the 10 neighborhood of dexamethasone. And that's 7.5 is what they're giving us. And that's close enough.
So 50 milligrams of prednisone, and I've just memorized this, but I like your fact better, is about 7.5 milligrams of dexamethasone and 200 milligrams of hydrocortisone. So if you have to do that conversion. All right. So a patient has been on an oral steroid therapy for a dermatological problem for 2 years. She's to undergo a cholecystectomy. In order to prevent secondary adrenal insufficiency, the most appropriate approach to perioperative steroid coverage would include which one of the following? A, hydrocortisone, 100 milligrams PO at the time of oral benzodiazepine premedication. B, 50 to 75 milligrams hydrocortisone IV at the time of induction. C, 50 to 75 milligrams hydrocortisone IV at the time of induction, followed by a rapid taper back to the usual dose. D, 25 milligrams hydrocortisone IV at the time of induction, or E, 100 to 150 milligrams hydrocortisone IV at the time of induction, followed by a rapid taper back to the usual dose.
And I'm moving and this is a little tough because some of this matters how much they're on, right? So again, if this patient were on 5 of prednisone a day and they took it that day, you know, you probably could wait and not give anything and just, if they get hypotensive, think, well, maybe they need some more. If they're on, you know, what I've always had in my head, and again, I'm not, this may or may not be exactly right, is 20 milligrams as kind of a cutoff. If they're on 20 milligrams or more of prednisone a day or prednisone equivalent a day, that's where they really should get stress dose steroids for any significant procedure. And I always think of it as 100 milligrams. That isn't, exactly 100 isn't a choice here. So you have to go with either 50 to 75 or 100 to 150. I think going above 100 is really not necessary. So I would stay back a little bit. Maybe they're being a little conservative and go with the 50 to 75 and then a rapid taper back to their usual dose.
So I think for this one, you could get to C and E pretty obviously. I think with the new test format, you wouldn't have like such a close range. It'd be a little bit closer. Hold on. 1 second. Let me let my dogs. Luke, Finn, come here, guys. Okay. So our next question, and this is the last one in the steroid category, is we have a 59-year-old man with recent cholangitis undergoing an open cholecystectomy under general anesthesia, and he develops intraoperative hypotension, unresponsive to vasopressors and fluids, and there's no sign of hemorrhage. What drug would you administer at this point? This is the one you were giving away. So A, hydrocortisone, 100 milligrams IV, B, regular insulin 5 units, glucagon 1 milligram, D, levothyroxine 100 micrograms, or E, 50 ml of 50% glucose IV.
Yeah. And, you know, I think this is not an easy question only because, you know, it's not clear that they're painting the picture of adrenal insufficiency, but what they want you to see is this guy recently had cholangitis, so he was pretty sick. You can imagine maybe he was even in the ICU, very sick and septic. And patients like that can end up with relative adrenal insufficiency where they just can't mount as much of a adrenal response to stress as they should be able to. And so they may need, even though they don't have their adrenal gland isn't non-functional, they still may need stress dose steroids. And so that's the picture they're painting. And 100 milligrams of hydrocortisone is a good stress dose. So A is going to be the answer here. There's no reason any of that other stuff makes any sense in this picture.
Okay, so our next key point is Cushing's disease, which is hypercortisolemia, either primary or secondary, is when the body makes too much cortisol. It's usually in response to a pituitary tumor, so it's usually secondary, but you can have primary. And Cushing's syndrome is a type of Cushing's disease, but it's when you have too much endogenous use of cortisol, so you've been taking too much of it. So here's a question. A 15-year-old, 65-kilo patient with Cushing's disease is to undergo a transsphenoidal hypophysectomy to remove a pituitary adenoma.
And sorry, Jillian, let me just interrupt for a second. I think Cushing's is from endogenous, right? So in other words, it's from your own adrenal, not from exogenous.
Okay, my fault. So we have a 15-year-old who's having a transsphenoidal hypophysectomy to remove a pituitary adenoma. You induce general anesthesia with propofol, intubated without any problem on a vecuronium drip, getting isoflurane, nitrous, and oxygen. The patient gets mannitol. At the end, you go to the extubated and go to the ICU. So over the next 6 hours post-op, the patient has a total urine output of 8.3 liters. Serum sodium concentration is 154. Serum potassium is 4.8 and serum glucose is 160. Urine specific gravity is 1.002 and urine osmolality is 125. The most likely cause of the large urine output is A, osmotic diuresis from mannitol, B, excess mineralocorticoid activity, C, hyperglycemia, or D, central diabetes insipidus.
Yeah, so they're painting this picture here of a patient having a transsphenoidal surgery, and the unknown complication of that and removing a pituitary adenoma is central diabetes insipidus. So that's really got to be high in your differential. You can get rid of hyperglycemia because the glucose concentration is, it's not totally normal, but it's not high enough to cause a huge amount of diuresis. The mannitol was given intraoperatively, and this urine output continues over 6 hours post-op, which is too long for it to be just from the mannitol. Excess mineralocorticoid activity would cause anti-diuresis. It would not cause diuresis. So that leaves you with central diabetes insipidus.
Okay. So one more question here. So adverse effects of epidurally administered glucocorticoids include all of the following except. So another except. So A, Cushing syndrome, B, osteoporosis, C, avascular bone necrosis, D, hypoglycemia, E, suppression of the hypothalamic pituitary axis. So in my head, I went back and reread this question, and it must be kind of like a chronic, like long-term, like multiple like steroid injections of like someone who's got like back pain, who gets a lot of steroid injections in their back. That's the only way this made sense to me.
Right. So I think that's right. They're getting at a lot of exogenous steroids being given that's getting systemic. And so Cushing's, if you get enough, yes, right, you're going to have excess cortisol. Osteoporosis, you can get from too much cortisol. Same with avascular bone necrosis. You can get hyperglycemia, but not hypoglycemia. So D is false, and that's going to be the correct answer. And then suppression of the hypothalamico-pituitary axis can happen as well.
Okay, and that leads us to our last key point in the advanced section of the adrenal gland is primary hyperaldosteronism, which is also known as Kahn's syndrome. I know we've gotten away from names, but people who are like me, who are a little older, still remember like Cushing's and Kahn's, even though we're getting away from it. It's usually the result of an aldosterone-producing adenoma, and it causes increased aldosterone, which results in hypertension, hypernatremia, and hypokalemia. So the opposite of adrenal insufficiency. So which of the following medical therapies for primary hyperaldosteronism, which is Kahn syndrome, would be the most effective for the majority of causes? A, glucocorticoids, B, calcium channel blocker, C, amiloride, or D, spironolactone?
So they want to know which of the following primary hyperaldosteronism would be the most effective for the majority of causes. And spironolactone, if you think about primary hyperaldosteronism, spironolactone is what a lot of these patients are on. So maybe that helps you get there. Otherwise, I think this is going to be, you know, something you're going to have to just know.
So I read the explanation that they gave for this question, and I found it very interesting in that they say the prevalence of primary hyperaldosteronism is almost 10% in all hypertensive patients. I didn't realize that. And if you just have an adenoma on one side, you can have it taken out. And fun fact, the very first laparoscopic surgery I saw was an adrenalectomy. It'd be a bilateral adrenal hyperplasia. They don't want to take out both adrenal glands. So they usually start with spironolactone. That's your first line. And then they can add on amiloride as your second line. But spironolactone is the first line here. Okay, last question for adrenal gland. A 39-year-old man has been diagnosed with primary hyperaldosteronism. He is expected to have all of the following manifestations except A, excess secretion of hormone from the adrenal medulla, B, hypertension, C, metabolic alkalosis, D, hypokalemia.
So again, we're looking for that true false, and we want the one that is false as the correct answer. So excess secretion of hormone from the adrenal medulla in a patient with primary hyperaldosteronism. So it's not the adrenal medulla. And so that is false. And that's going to be our answer. With primary hyperaldosteronism, you absolutely are going to get hypertension, metabolic alkalosis, and hypokalemia, and then inability to concentrate urine. All of those are going to be things you can get.
Yes. So take home points for all of this. So I think the highest yield subjects, it's probably going to be that hypothalamus pituitary adrenal axis, because there are so many ways they can test that, a pheochromocytoma or hyperaldosteronism and Cushing's disease. I think those are really the big ones here. But I think in this section of questions, I don't know, I think we probably covered about 20, 25 questions today. You're probably likely to see between 3 and 5 of these. They definitely come up over and over.
Absolutely. Awesome. Thank you, Jillian. Let's turn to the part of our show where we make random recommendations. Anything you have on your mind that you'd recommend people check out, a good book you've read recently or something like that?
Well, it's a book I reread recently. So my dad was a huge Civil War buff, and he would take us, oh my gosh, to the battlefields, which let me tell you, is so boring. It's like, this is the Battle of Bull Run, and it's like literally a field. There's like nothing there. And he would drive us like to Manassas and like Bull Run. But he got me interested in the Battle of Gettysburg. And there's a great book called The Killer Angels, which is like historical fiction, but it tells the Battle of Gettysburg from the sides of each general. And it shows you how many bad decisions the South made, and which resulted in the loss of that battle. And that was like a key turning point in the like end of the Civil War and it tipping towards the North over the South. So well written. I think it won a Pulitzer Prize. It's by Jeff or Michael. When he died, his son took over and wrote two more Civil War books, but they're not nearly as good as the first one, which is The Killer Angels. Let me just Google it really fast. By the way, I took your recommendation. I started doing the connections on the New York Times.
Oh, it's great, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. Well, initially I was like, this is so easy. I get all of them. Then I have had a row of like really hard ones.
Some days they're impossible some days. But yeah, I do think it's fun.
Michael Schur, The Killer Angels by Michael Schur.
Nice. I have read that. It's a good book. Well, I'm going to recommend, it's a little bit circuitous, but I was watching the Super Bowl. This was yesterday. We're recording the day after the Super Bowl. And, one of the commercials was Arnold Schwarzenegger, playing agent, you know, agent, whatever, agent State Farm. And then at the end, they had him and Danny DeVito sitting next to each other in a movie theater. And it was a throwback to the movie Twins. So the movie Twins is something that, you know, I haven't seen it in a long time, but have fond memories of. But it reminded me then of a interview I heard with Arnold Schwarzenegger recently on the podcast Smartless. So Smartless is a great podcast. I think I've shouted it out before. If you don't listen to it, check it out. It's great. Will Arnett, Jason Bateman, and Sean Hayes are the hosts. But they interviewed Arnold Schwarzenegger on a relatively recent one, and it's a really great interview. It's fun to hear him talk about like the initial Terminator movie and how he got involved in it, and you know what how going from an actor to governor of California and all that stuff. So check out Smartless interview with Arnold Schwarzenegger, and watch Twins again if you haven't in a while.
Do you ever listen to Conan O'Brien's podcast?
Conan needs a friend. Absolutely, yeah, it's hilarious.
Arnold is on one of those. Arnold, like I know him, like we're on a first name basis, but Arnold Schwarzenegger. But one of the things he says, which I absolutely love, is Schwarzenegger says, like, everyone talks about him being a self-made man. He's like, I'm absolutely not a self-made man. Like those, you know, when I moved to California and the people who bought me gym memberships and let me sleep on their couch and, you know, help me buy food, you know, all of that counts. And I love how humble he is in the midst of like all his success. So.
Totally agree. And Conan Needs a Friend's a great podcast as well. Awesome. Jillian, thanks so much for coming back on the show. All right. Hopefully you got as much out of that as I did. That was really fantastic. Let us know what you thought. Go to the website, acrac.com, where you can leave a comment. Others can learn from what you have to say. If you are a fan of the show, you can follow us. We're on Twitter. We are on Facebook. We are on Reddit. And we are on Instagram. I'm at Jay Wolpaw on Twitter, and we're at Acrac Podcast. And you can find us on all those other platforms as well. If you are a fan of the show, please consider going to Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts and leaving a comment and a rating. It really helps others find the show. If you'd like to support the making of the show, please consider going to patreon.com/acrac. That's patreon.com/accrac, where you can become a patron of the show. Even if it's just a dollar or two that you pledge, it makes a big difference and we really appreciate it. You can also make donations anytime by going to paypal.me/acrac or looking up Jay Wolpaw on Venmo. Thank you so much to those who have already made donations and become patrons. We really appreciate it. Thanks, as always, to our fantastic ACRAC crew. Sonia Amanat is our tech lead, and Sophia Wu is our social media manager. Thank you so much for the great work that you do. Our original ACRAC music is by Dr. Dennis Kuo. You can check out his website at studymusicproject.com. All right, that is it for today. For the ACRAC podcast, I'm Jed Wolpaw. Thanks for listening. Remember, what you're doing out there every day is really important and valued.